Blog Talk Radio.
It's Green Talk Live and more
on Real Talk Radio with the chef.
I'm Chef Moses.
And I'm Chef Rivera. Welcome to our first show.
Tonight we're gonna talk about something that is very serious and very the information is very informative. I think it's prevalent to all of the stuff that's going on. By the way, just to let you know, Green Talk Live is about green talk. Anything talking, dealing with, and pertaining to ecosystems, green initiatives, farming, agriculture, green things in general. The spectrum, the gambit. So, but tonight we are going to talk about something that is really serious and that is affecting us, but because of our everyday lives and our fast-paced
world, the hustle and bustle,
all these things, we don't know what to pick and what to prioritize in our lives. But I think tonight we're going to shatter that factor. I think that what I am about to talk about is something that everyone knows about to a degree, and it's frightening that, believe it or not, there's a lot more people that don't know about
the after effects.
Yeah, Fukushima in Japan. So tonight our topic is going to be, for the first half, we're going to be discussing about Fukushima and the effects of Fukushima from some of the data and information. What we're going to hear is even before this meltdown, a little bit before the tsunami hit, there was actually leakage from a previous earth, 1002.
Mm-hmm.
So that means that they were actually, they were aware that there were leaks from the earthquake in Fukushima. So just to bring you up to speed again, what we're going to do, I'm going to give you some excerpts.
This is something that's affecting, and it's prevalent within the United States, and there's several newscasts that are going on that aren't being reported on mainstream media about Fukushima and its effects and how the United States was about to evacuate California, which is documented and not reported effectively the way it should have been. And there's like a high level risk of cancer, even more so because of the leakage. I understand that people want, the American public to go back to living their lives despite what had happened. But it's very important.
What is happening.
And what it is happening, it's not something that ended. It's something that has a continuous effect on the ocean, which affects the sea life, which affects ecological systems all over the world. And it's very serious. And these type of things are being monitored despite the fact of the blackout from the American press, actually the global press, really.
And, believe it or not, there still are some people that believe actually that this doesn't affect them, and how can it affect them, and this, that, and the other. But, like I said, what's so funny is bear with me for a second. Nuclear radiation, right? If rods are hot and extremely hot and need to be cooled, and the water that is poured on these rods evaporates and becomes steam and floats up into the air. Now, I'm not talking about it like a pot where you put some water in and you just, douse the fire and, you'll see a little steam. I'm talking about hundreds of gallons, hundreds of thousands of gallons being poured on something that is so hot that it's burning, it's burning it, it's evaporating before it can even, really fully go get down to the other rods. So the thing is that all of this vapor is going up into the atmosphere. Now, mind you, as this vapor is going up into the atmosphere, all of this cesium-127 and strontium and iodine-131, all of these things are prevalent, and they're inside the vapor, the steam. So these molecules are there. Now, they were ascending up into the atmosphere, the ionosphere, the stratosphere, all of these different spheres. They catch a wind current, and they travel the circumference of the globe. Did you? You did? Now, get a shovel. Again, they're traveling the circumference of the globe. They're catching wind currents, and they're traveling the globe. So now all of these particles... Mm-hmm. Trapped inside here. And some, now, mind you, some don't get up that high because as they go up higher, they have a tendency to cool off and then they come back down as ice. So, you know, certain places, some of this stuff came down as ice. And, you know, as, you know, we're just talking right now to, just to bring some people up to speed that might not know or might not be aware. Or, you know, whoever's listening to a large degree out there, you know, being that this is the wake-up call, the wake-up show.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, like I said, it's something that we have to really start to discuss because if our ecosystem is, think of it like this too. If our ecosystem is affected to the point where there is cesium 137 and all these other types of radioactive isotopes and all of this other stuff that's in the water. The thing is that once it gets in the water, again, it's going to travel the cycle. The cycle is the sun heats the water evaporates, goes into steam, seeds clouds. So radiation is going to keep pouring down on us. So there's, it seems like there's no, it's no, there's no escaping. Now we can, you know, sit here and act like that, you know, this is not going to happen or.
Well, it's not going to affect us in the long run, but that's not true.
Right, right. And you know what? There is no, you know, the best catalyst for, the best catalyst is to be told the truth. Once you have the truth, then you could work and deal with it. Some of the stuff that I'm going to bring out tonight, you know, it's really, you know, it's being projected that, you know, if not done, it's going to take us about 40 years, supposedly. That's the projection. Now, if that's the projection, you know, usually when they come out with a first projection, it's usually not so like the sixth projection that, you know, they really get it right. So, we have to bear with that. So now, if the projection is 40 years, you can just imagine what we're really talking about. And now, check this out. It's not just about the 40 years. It's about, if it's not done 100% accurate, it is projected that it will be damaged for thousands of generations to come. Have to pause. You have to really think. You have to think about all these things. And, you know, there's people that are skeptic and it would be like, well, you know what? No, it's not. And we can, you know, we're going to be all right. And everything, no, it's not. And who likes to bring, no one likes to be the bearer of bad news. But the thing is, you know what? Prevention is a cure.
Mm-hmm.
Believe it or not, there is preventative ways to, green ways to actually combat this and many more of the unfortunate things that are going to happen. The thing is to be prepared. And let me just give you a little excerpt, right? The west coast of the United States is being absolutely fired by radiation from Fukushima. Nuclear disaster. The mainstream media is not telling us the truth about this. What we are about to see is a collection, well, what you're about to hear is a collection of evidence that is quite startling. Taken collectively from a body of evidence shows that nuclear radiation from Fukushima is affecting the sea life in the Pacific Ocean and animal life along the west coast of North America in some extraordinary way. By the mainstream media continues to insist that we don't have the things, nothing to worry about. The mainstream media continues to insist that radiation levels in the Pacific and along the west coast are perfectly safe. Do you believe that your media, the mainstream media, is telling you the truth about this? You know, I think that in the American public and in general, in society, a collective of people, a corporate collective, have a tendency to buy power, and therefore the truth doesn't get out.
Right.
So because the truth's not getting out, sometimes there's a cycle. It's called the, let's use the metaphor, let's use revolution. The revolution is actually the metaphor we're using to describe when a thing becomes a monopoly.
Mm-hmm.
And then they have to be deregulated. So now the revolution comes when the deregulation is formed, and by this deregulation being formed, you have in your mix parties that are willing to, I'm sorry, we have parties that are willing to get on board and become this new thing, this new feeling, they express their, you know, energy, electronics, cell phones, you know, new companies popping up all over the place. So that's the revolution. That's the form of the revolution. But what's happening is
one of the people that are on the chat room. We have a chat room also, as well as a call in for people who don't want to necessarily have their voices heard, but they go into the chat room in Green Talk Live with It's Real Talk Radio. The question that the person said was, did Japan shut down the news so they could release radiation water into the ocean?
Yes, caller, this is true. Actually, they have, ever since the day it happened, the first day, more than 300 tons of cesium-137, iodine-131, and strontium. So strontium-80, and a vast other of different chemicals were released into the sea. As far as Tokyo Bay is concerned, they're still releasing vast amounts of water that's contaminated. And we're talking about quadrillions of becquerels of radiation. This is quadrillions? This is an amazing statement. This is an amazing statement. Radiation has a becquerel is 30.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're saying an isotope of radiation at a when it's measured, this is what it's called. It's the equation, the number, it comes out to 30. So I'm saying if there's a projection too. I hope I answered that call on that chat room caller's answer. But there is a projection also that in about the next 5 to 6 years, all of the water, all of the oceans will be totally contaminated,
mm-hmm,
with high levels of radiation. And, you know, the fish, the other marine life are carrying and trying to get away from these things, but they're going to be able to contaminate the whole ocean. So, I mean, you know, like I said, it's something that, you know, we're talking about, and you know, it really doesn't sink in because we're humans and mm-hmm. we have this thing where, you know, you have to show me the money and you have to show me things first, you know. And, you know, like I said, there are a lot of things and that are going on around us, but because my life is not your life mm-hmm. and because, you know, I'm just saying, I'm in my life, I might not have to do what you have to do or what someone else has to do. And, you know, someone's worried about paying a light bill or paying a phone bill or paying for gas or something like, you know, it's about to be cut off or something like that. So that's more important than, you know, what other people are thinking. That person has to get through and try to deal with, you know, what's important in their lives. So, I mean, you know, it's a different vibe, man. It's a different look. But here's a little something. According to Oceanic Magazine, the total amount of cesium-137 that has been released into the Pacific Ocean from Fukushima is about 10,000 times to 100,000 times greater than the amount released in the ocean by Chernobyl, by the Chernobyl disaster, or by the atmospheric nuclear weapons test of the 60s. And it was a place called Bikini Alto. That was a place where the government did a lot of nuclear fission testing, but the stuff that they were doing back then was like caveman-ish. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, the testing.
Very primitive.
Very, extremely primitive mm-hmm. compared to some of the devices that were later accompanied by Bikini Alto and all that testing that was done out there. But this is, remind you, 10,000 times to 100,000 times greater than the amount released in the oceans by Chernobyl disaster or by the atmospheric. Now, mind you, atmospheric means that at one point that they were releasing, they were detonating bombs
mm-hmm.
in air, above ground, not in the water, not under the island, not anything dug, not, you know, so, of course, you have particles from that blast that would actually get up into the atmosphere, and, you know, and it did cause a lot of devastation to a large degree, especially the inhabitants, the original inhabitants of those islands that were named after, and that island, mind you, a little trivia, a French designer came out with the bikini and named it after the beach, because it was back then it was hot. A little trivia, you know. Can't forget, you know, to add the little, have to add that in with all of the madness and the stuff that's around the stuff. But, you know, like I said, it's, the information is something that you are supposed to process,
mm-hmm.
and it allows you to move and to think better. See, so a lack of knowledge, always remember, a lack of knowledge is information that you don't have.
Yep.
So by having all of the necessary information, whether it be true or false, the thing is that you have to, that's the other thing too, to decipher. But, you know, let's have a conversation about it. Let's talk about it. Let's discuss
mm-hmm.
it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, instead of being, you know, misrepresented by, you know, the foolishness and the
shenanigans with politics.
Yeah, with politics and, you know, I would think that a sponsor would love to hear the truth. Of course, you don't want to, you know, the truth can be turned on you to a degree or whatever the case is, but I think people want to be told the truth. I mean, we're grown-ups, we're adults, we hate when our children lie to us, so why would we want to be lied to?
Mm-hmm.
You know? Listen, let me go.
In the interim of Chef getting more information for us, the proof ecologically is that most of the sea life in the ocean has rerouted to different parts of the ocean that they usually don't breed and dwell. Number one. Number two, some of the sea life in the ocean also beaches itself up to different shores across the United States and across the world and die. And when they do the autopsies on these animals, they find cancerous sores,
malignant tumors,
right.
Open wounds,
disproportionate parts of the body from absorbing all that nuclear waste that's in the ocean. These things they want to hide from and not scare the public and tell you to go to the beach and things like that. We're not going to tell you whether you should go or you shouldn't go.
I'll remind you, we are not in no way, shape, or form doctors
right.
telling you any of that. You already know the spiel behind all of that.
Right.
All we are saying is that common sense is a good preventative. That's it. I don't need this. No, I ain't going to leave it at that. I just won't leave it at that. Common sense, you know, rains, comes down, it's bad, careful. That's all you can do.
Green Talk Live was created, so you know, since it's the first show, to have a discussion forum for environmental issues, because what's going on there, from what we see, when we listen to the mainstream media, which is backed by roughly 5 corporations in the United States and abroad, a lot of the stuff is just blacked out because the whole emphasis, in my opinion, which is solely my opinion, just to entertain and keep people with that bumblebee ideology to just do what you got to do and, you know, be entertained when you need to relax and then go back to that same grind over and over again.
But no research was in the background.
Right. So with that being said, we ourselves as activists ourselves and organizers in our own community where we live at, we got exhausted with the, you know, with the nonsense that certain things that, you know, are when I question don't get the answers that are imperative. So we decided to create a discussion forum verbally and virtually to get our information out.
Address some of these issues
and other authors and other people that, you know, are, you know, risking their lives in a sense to bring this stuff out, because media just doesn't want to put this stuff out. They don't want to scare the public. They want everybody to have this ideology that everything is okay. If your health is at risk, I personally don't see it being okay.
I was going to listen. If you cannot, if we not all have the same problems today, anybody that knows me knows this one right here. We might not all have the same problems today, but when the stuff hits the fan, your money, your problems are going to be all of our problems. We are all going to have the same problems. And that same problem, that number one problem, is going to be that fresh food and fresh water. So where is it coming from? But let me ask you a question. How much is it going to cost? If it's going to cost anything. You know, I mean, these are the things that we should be, you know,
really concentrating on.
Really concentrating on. And, you know, believe it or not, there are some dugout places, you know, so to speak. No, not even so to speak. There are some places that are dug out that are prepared for all of these things that we are talking about right now and anticipated upon. You know, and one of the alternatives, without question. So,
we have to create our own alternatives.
Exactly. We have to learn to survive and to adapt, not just with this, but just with whatever life hits us with to a large degree. Again, information is power. But let me hit you with something, though. There are bald eagles that are dying in unprecedented numbers in Utah. And nobody can figure out why this is happening. Bald eagles are dying in Utah, 20 in the past few weeks alone, and nobody can figure out why. Hundreds of these majestic birds, many with wingspans of 7 feet and more, migrate here. Each winter gathering along the Great Lakes and feasting on carps and fish in the swim in the nearby fresh lakes and the bays. So, I mean, mind you, they're eating this fish. that is in the lakes and in the bays, and I, you know, they're doing what they normal, their normal routine is. But I'm pretty sure some of these birds can not even sense to the degree yet that some of the stuff is contaminated, because usually animals can, you know, detect these things. But apparently senses of, I mean, for a long, we've been having problems for a minute. Again, like I told you, ever since 2002, with the first earthquake that hit Fukushima. Now, you have to remember, 2002, it started to leak, and it was leaking from then. So, I mean, you know, like I said, it's crazy. I mean, sometimes you really have to, you know, it's one thing to sit down and talk about it, and, you know, this information, some of this information can be overwhelming. And sometimes, you know, it's like a synaptic shutdown. I think that we've been fed so much as consumers, and I think the thing is that we were supposed to be able to handle every and anything. And the reality is that it's played out, and everybody just follows each other's lead to a large degree. And, you know, no mass panic, and it's not supposed to be like that, but the thing is to inform. But now, you know, when you're not informed, then, you know, somebody's ringing your bell, you know, like ding dong, and, you know, coming up to you, open the door, and they tell you, well, listen, you know what? You got like 10 minutes to live. So now, you know, you know, all of these emotions and these feelings, you know, popping up in your mind, and you're feeling some way, you know? The thing is like, well, damn, I wish I hadn't been, you know, I wish somebody had told me, you know, when this was going on, mm-hmm. that this is what was going on. But it's unfair because I have children. So I'm not I am somebody's child, Doris Marion Moses. I am their child, but I'm a grown man, and I want to be treated as such with, you know, all of these so-called, you know, all of these rights that I have. The thing is that these rights are not doing me any good in anything.
If your health is at risk.
Yeah, if my health is at risk, but I mean, if I can't exercise, if I can't depend on the politicians that I put in office to, even if I am the layman, to explain and express to me what is going on and what is really going on, then, I mean, what, listen, what mindset are these, what mindset are these guys in? Real talk. Mm-hmm. What mindset are these guys in? Hello, if you have no constituents and everyone's dead, you have no job.
And you definitely won't get any more money.
And as far as economy goes, the boy.
What economy?
Well, there's not, you know, of course there's not going to be any, but, you know, I really just don't want to say what I'm saying and how I'm saying it. But if you can understand, you know, what happens is if all of the sheeple are dead. If all of the sheeple are dead, nothing.
Then there's no economy.
Nothing. No, there's no more fiat. There's no more funny money to be made and then be distributed on a massive level and scale. So then what happens? Okay, the 1% or whoever, whatever, everyone lives, and then everyone else.
The 99%
just dies. And
non-existent.
Well, hey, listen, I've learned through now, you know, this thing is, you know, the theory of evolution. Say that no matter what, a species learns how to survive and adapt. So, I don't know. I don't foresee, like, tumoretic cats walking around the planet with just tumors all over their, you know, bodies. But, I mean, we're an adaptable species. So, I think that, you know, like I said, all of these things that we're, you know, we have some time to kick it in and talk. But it's just that, again, to get a feel and to let you understand how serious it is, even though it might seem a little, I think the laughter that you might hear is more of, it's not more like ha, ha, ha. It's more like, you know, it's sad. And, you know, if you can't see it, then you're blind to the fact. I can't see it. I see it, but, I mean, what other way to express when a person my age and at this stage of my life would have to feel the need to take some information it's not being distributed. So now I feel like it's my, who appointed me? Who appointed Chef? Who appointed us to do this? You know? And you come to a point in your life where you see life is not, we've all been there. We've all been to that point in our lives. And the only way that I can describe it, I'm just saying, a very perfect example is when, you know, you've been to school all these years and, you know, you were taught like Christopher Columbus discovered America, and then when you got older, you know, you had some type of analytical reasoning with you, and now you had to decipher, well, wait a minute, how can he found it when there were people here already? So, but then you say, well, why was I taught that? But that's the example, the metaphor that I'm using. And I think sometimes we're human now, but, you know, what would make me want to do this? What made me want to do this is we all have children. And
if there's nothing to leave the children, then what?
I mean, it's sad and it's sick that, you know, we're at a stage in our so-called evolution that, you know, we are destroying ourselves. And it's not even black or white.
It's green.
It's green.
And it's not an issue to leave, it's about money.
But again, I mean, how rich do you want to be that you could just overlook something? That you could overlook some shit that you're not really supposed to overlook? There's no other way to explain it. You know, the people that overlooked it, that took the payola, it's affecting their families now. Was it worth it? Was it good enough for you? Was it enough money for you? Was it enough? You want some more? You want some more? That's what you want. Want some more. But then if the whole earth is contaminated, you can't use that money for nothing. But when
there's no buyer, seller, trade. Nothing.
Oh, well, not just that. I mean, but just in general, I mean, you can't do anything. You can't do shit. There's nothing else to be said. And, you know, of course, I could have been a little bit more, you know, professional instead of that, but it's just sickening, man. This lust, this greed for this accumulation of this fiat,
stuff.
Man, this stuff, man. It's sickening. And now, don't get me wrong, of course, we know it has to, you know, it rules the world, it runs the world. So, you know, on that being said, I'm going to get back to, before I go off into other than green talk live, let me stop. but yeah, like I said, there's birds that's, you know, that's dying, that's dropping out of the air. And listen, there's been a huge number of deaths of birds that are
mm-hmm.
dropping dead in Washington along the coastlines of Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
It is being reported that many of the carcasses of the dead birds are broken open and bleeding.
Mm. Without surgery, without an autopsy.
Broken open and broken open, right? So that means like as if it burst because it was broken open and bleeding.
That's the radiation. From the inside out. Wow.
But, you know, we're not scientists.
This is documented.
Yeah, this is documented facts and evidence, but
mm-hmm.
But something is also causing a large number of seals and walruses up in Alaska to lose hair and develop oozing sores. Oozing sores. There's a substantial number of polar bears along the coast of Alaska that are suffering from fur loss and open sores. So now, again, what's going on? It has to be something in the water. Do you need to be a scientist to understand that something is going on? All right, so now, you know, follow the trail. These things are happening. These things are being documented. There's no getting around it. Now, okay, let's say, for instance, that all of this was somehow bullshit. Let's just say that. Honestly, no. Couldn't be. It really truly couldn't be, because there's so many different incidents that are happening all across the United States. Isolated not being one of them. What's so sad, the mainstream media is not reporting it, of course. But there are, you know, it's, you know, because we are a culture of people here in America that love to share information. We love to let our neighbors know what's going on to a large degree. And I don't care. It's not just here in America, though, but it's just been like
global
that.
Now.
Yeah, so, but, I mean, people, culture, you know, people's culture always had some way of, you know, talking to you, letting you know what's going on, mm-hmm. you know, whether it was some, you know, through music or oral or whatever, the spoken word. It's just, it was something that was done at that moment, and some of it even was passed down. So, I mean, culture is about sharing and talking about these things, but I think people have underestimated the so-called American people to a large degree. People want to be informed, you know, to a large degree,
mm-hmm.
because now that's the mindset. The mindset wasn't like that. Now, everybody that wants to be informed and that is informed wasn't always at one time informed.
And see, that's why there's a lot of protesting going on all over the world about the global climatic systematic changes that are happening, and it's affecting everybody. If it's not Fukushima, it's the XL pipeline, which is still in an uproar, and the battle rages on with that. But it's the corporations, because of their monetary influences and political influences.
Speaking about that, what you just said.
It's incredible.
I was just reading something about how one of the companies that want to do the XL pipeline,
mm-hmm.
What they're doing is putting grants, allowing the community board, you know, like, to go through, not the community, but they're allowing grants. They want to facilitate environmental grants to the pipeline, you know, underneath the bay and out into the ocean. So, I mean, here's the dilemma. Here's our dilemma. Our dilemma is we are already living on top of a bomb. I'm just saying. Just with gas and, yeah, in general, the way everything is laid out and situated. And, you know, we're living on one big bomb to a large degree. So, I really, you know, do I really need a PhD or a master's or a doctorate of science to really understand, you know, certain things, you know, just certain shit you just don't do there. There's no other way to explain it. Well, you know, it's like talking to your child, knowing that they did what they did, but you're really trying, you're going that extra mile to really try to make them understand what you're doing is wrong. And if you keep that train of thinking up, you're going to be worse off than you are right now. All that's flashing through your head and your mind. But, you know, you want the best, but it's just sickening.
All we can do is just inform, and, you know, and the battle rage is on. It's about money. That's the bottom line to it. It's solely about money. It's about the financiers. It's about the military-industrial complex. It's about these super wealthy cats that, you know, their whole thing is about to absorb as much as they can get at the expense of the public. I said, that's just what it is. It's it is what it is, and that's why a whole bunch of groups are coming together, partnering in different ways throughout the world to combat and circumvent a lot of things that even them as organizations can't really fully convey to the public themselves, because it's so intricate and it's so malign of the you know, these global plans of, you know, with this environmental situations and stuff. So
yeah, well,
it's deep. It's deeper than we think.
And if we have any listeners that are in the chat room, you know, you're welcome to call, you know, to call up and join the discussion. All you have to dial is 347-838-9540. And thank you for, you know, joining the chat.
Joining us in general.
And, yeah, come in, holler at the chefs. Also, there's also an epidemic of sea lions, the deaths. There's a lot of sea lions that are, you know, dying in, off the coastline of California.
To date, right now.
And more as we're talking. The population of socket-eyed salmon along the coastlines of Alaska, they're at their historic low as we're speaking right now.
Mm. That's why all the seafood is very expensive, because it's the fishermen trying to get the best of the worst and, you know, trying to fish for what they can fish for, which is safe, and then, you know, everything is getting stricter with the fishermen's guidelines and stuff like that, because it's that prevalent, the dangers and the health risks to the public.
Well, you know, also, I think, you know, we've had a historic problem with salmon for many, many years. If most people, if you can remember, the last time you saw a whole salmon in the market, you'll see a salmon in the market, but you probably won't see it with its head cut off. That's what you're gonna see.
And as chefs, we know what it is with all that stuff to a large degree.
You know, I think that, you know, parasitically wise, there was always a problem with salmon to a large degree. You know, there are a lot of genetically engineered salmon now to a very much more large degree. But I think to wipe out and to try to get rid of these parasites that were infesting the salmon is, I think it was, nevertheless, just to let you also know, there's something that seems to be causing a substantial spike in the death rate of killer whales living off the coast of British Columbia.
Mm-hmm.
Experts have found very high levels of cesium-137 in the plankton living in the waters off the Pacific Ocean between Hawaii and the West Coast.
So please note, this particular document that Chef Moses is reading was released to the public, whoever could get their hands on it, December of last year, which is 2013. So this is recent information.
A gentleman by the name of Michael Schneider, zoologically.
Mm-hmm.
As we go on, you know, you have to see, that's the thing, too. You have to give credit to people that are taking the initiative and the steps to come out and tell the truth, and this information has to be shared. I think it's very important. Let me go on. One of the tests in California that was found, 15 out of 15 bluefin tuna were contaminated with radioactive particles from Fukushima. Right? So now, listen to this. Back in 2012, the Vancouver Sun reported that cesium-137 was being found in a very high percentage of the fish that Japan was selling to Canada. So now, back in 2012, this was going on. But now the percentage of fish that it was dealing with, it wasn't just like one particular fish. It's like 73% of the mackerel, 91% of the halibut, 92% of the sardines, 93% of the tuna and eel, 94% of the cod and anchovies, 100% of the carp, seaweed, shark, and monkfish. And actually, the EU, the European Union, found and funded a study that concluded that Fukushima released up to 210 quadrillion barquels of cesium-137 into the atmosphere.
Okay.
Now, remember what I just told you before, previous.
Mm-hmm.
30 barquels is, it's radioactive. Now, anything over that is just like catastrophic. Now, mind you, there's no other way to say it. I mean, that's 210 quadrillion. That's a lot into the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
Into our atmosphere. This is what. Now, mind you, if that was a study, you know how it is. We're humans. We have a tendency of not telling the truth and not telling the whole thing to a large degree, or making it so that everybody won't be worried. But 210 quadrillion? That's a lot. So even if you missed it,
that's an alarming amount.
That really truly is. But I mean, you know, even if you're saying it like, well, let's not really alarm everybody. Let's just go with like...
Just off of that, that's alarming.
You know, like a couple of thousand, you know, parts per million or 2 billion parts per trillion. You know, let's... But they said, could come on. I mean, listen, creep the paddle.
That's why as chefs, we even more so decided to do this as well, because of the food supply is really, really going through a lot of upheavals with the environment, and that's the number one thing that we need as human beings to sustain ourselves and stay alive is food and water.
So, without the politics.
Without the politics and the shucking and jiving and all that nonsense, which in the end of it all, at the end of the day, it really is not going to amount to anything, and it's not going to be conducive to anyone, even the people that are in these positions of power that have, I mean, old money, ancient money. It really is not going to be. During Sandy, and, you know, we are Sandy survivors ourselves.
Since you said that, we are Sandy survivors ourselves. We are, but I'm going to show you just how parlor tricks and just things in general play themselves out. As survivors, we also did relief work. We were actually a half an hour after the lights went out in Far Rockaway. 2 days before Sandy made sure we were doing relief work. And this was before Red Cross, FEMA, Occupy Sandy. You know, big up to Occupy Sandy. I can't, you know, Occupy Sandy, you know, they came in, they did their thing. We can't, you know, I have to, you know, say that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and there was other organizations, NYCHA, actually ones that we partnered with before all of these other organizations came in.
Or were let go because of the executive decision of the president. Because what happens in those kind of situations is that there's an executive order and they have to lock the whole disaster area down and they have to do an assessment. And once that assessment is done and the president gets a report, and then him and his cabinet approves that report, that's when the public can go into the disaster areas, like nonprofit groups like Occupy Sandy and other groups that weren't based in Sandy areas.
Pick up the Brad Johnson too. You know,
not forecast the back.
Yeah, real talk. Chef Rivera is being modest, but Chef Rivera was at Washington, D.C. She was at the White House, and she delivered 280,000 signatures. And know, I'm proud of Chef Favela, definitely. And, you know, the thing is about the climate, the change. And
it's
Obama
affecting
actually, in the second part of his, because Chef Favela was, she was supposed to meet him, but she was taped. And they made sure that
he received the tape.
And he addressed the environment and some things that she said.
Questions that I asked, that was actually the answers that he gave back in the official transcript.
So the thing is that, you know, that's a good look. I think that if we can affect change in what we do on a small scale and a small level, if we can, you know, if we can apply it in our lives, in our everyday lives, we'll be able to apply it and get through what we're going to have to get through. But back to facts. It's being projected that the radioactivity of the coastal waters in the U.S. West Coast could be doubled over the next 5 to 7 to 6 years. According to one recent scientific report, radiation from Fukushima could affect our seafood for many generations and ultimately kill more than 1 million people. The Japanese government has estimated that approximately 300 tons of highly radioactive water is pouring into the Pacific Ocean from the destroyed Fukushima nuclear facility every single day. Now, that's 300 tons. So, I mean, you know, that's a lot. So we already know it's probably 6 to 1 million. A senior researcher of marine chemistry at the Japanese meteorology agency, research institute said that 30 billion backwards of radioactive cesium and 30 billion barrels of radioactive strontium are being released into the Pacific Ocean from Fukushima every single day. That's 30 billion. 30 billion. According to Tempo, a total of somewhere between 20 trillion and 40 trillion barrels of radioactive titanium has gotten into the Pacific Ocean since Fukushima disaster first began, right? According to a professor at Tokyo University, 3 gigabytes of backflows of cesium-137 is flowing into the port of Fukushima every single day. It is being projected that the significant levels of cesium-137 will reach every corner of the Pacific Ocean by the year 2020. This is a projection.
Mm-hmm.
But you got to remember, currents and, you know, all that stuff, some currents are faster, stronger, swifter than others. So, you know, we're looking at could be sooner. So, you know.
And as far as the presidency and stuff like that, the president's hands, in my opinion, is tied to a large degree. Because you got to understand one thing, and we tend to forget that as the American public, because we're so busy with our lives, America is run by corporations, and America is a corporation. So it's very intricate on how things are done, and there's so much that the president's seats can do. And it's not just the Obama administration. It's any president, any presidency since Lincoln. Everything is constructed and strategized and construed in a certain way to be run. And that's just what it is. It's about money. It's about tying the money in where the money's at. That's what the bottom line is. And unfortunately, the 99% suffers. That's just what it is, and it's unfortunate, but it's true.
Okay. We have iodine-131, cesium-137, and strontium-90 that are constantly being released from Fukushima and are going to affect the health and the living of the northern hemisphere for a very, very long time. Now, iodine-131, for example, it can be ingested into the thyroid where it emits beta particles, electrons, that damage tissue. A plague of damaged thyroids has also, it's been a plague of damage, a plague of damaged thyroids has already been reported among as many as 40% of the children in the Fukushima area. The percentage can only go higher. It can only go higher in developing youngsters, and it can stunt both physical and mental growth. I think season 137 from Fukushima has been found in fish caught as far away as California. It spreads through the body, but tends to accumulate in the muscles. Strontium 90, the half-life is around 29 years. It mimics calcium and goes to your bones directly. According to the Wall Street Journal, it is being reported, projected, that the cleanup of Fukushima could take up to 40 years to complete. Yale professor Charles Peru is warned that in the cleanup of Fukushima, if it is not handled with 100% precision, that humanity could be threatened for thousands of years. So, Fukushima's building, the reactor building 3, exploded on the 13th March 2011 as a result of a hydrogen buildup breaking the building's containment and emitting a huge plume of radiation. The reactor itself is in meltdown. Now, this was in 2011. They've had problems at this, you know, this plant previously. So, I mean, you know, it behooves us, you know, I'm about to wrap it up. You know, I will be chiming in with other things, but Fukushima is something that we have to worry about. There is a solution. We're going to...
Knowledge is one solution.
Yeah, knowledge is one solution, but we are going to... we're going to discuss this maybe in another show, and maybe some of the solutions and some of the things and some of the ways, some of the things that we can do to counter-react some of these things, though. But
on that note, the last thing that I have to say on Fukushima, I think all these governments need a one good scare of an environmental catastrophe so they can stop the shenanigans. So I'm not sure. No, they're not scared enough. In my opinion, they're not really scared enough. But there's going to come a time where things are just going to unravel environmentally that can't be hidden from CNN or any of these major corporate-sponsored media venues. And they're just going to have to say what it is, and the reporters are going to will have the permission to say what it is, uncut and unedited and unadulterated. So thank you guys for tuning in. The next hour will be a special guest of ours, a friend, a mentor, in agriculture in the country, one of our closest, dearest friends. We'll release that information in the next hour.
I have to say real quick, he is one of the founding fathers of the good food movement.
In this country and parts of the world, too.
All over the world, but definitely in New York back in the 60s. With a whole host of gentlemen, but he was one of the, like I said, one of the founding fathers, along with other gentlemen too. But we'll speak to him
in a few after the break. So
stay tuned. It's Green Talk Live and more
on Real Talk Radio with the Chef.
I'm Chef Moses.
I'm Chef Rivera. Thank you and welcome. Thanks for the support. See you in a little while.
Make my eyes get low, but she burns through my paper so fast. Gotta make it last. Hate to watch them switch and sweets walk past. When my personal styles get low, then it's back to the block trying to find her. Shorty, she's a dime. In fact, that girl's a dog. And I think I'm falling in love. She gets me all choked up. I can barely catch my breath.
Wake up, grind hard, get cream for her. Play the whip on the lean with her. Just in case I don't make it home, I'ma leave a team with her. Me and her been down since her hair was brown. I went to every part of the town and bought her around. And now she get loose with it. Her hair's purple and green, but she look cute with it. And I ain't mad at her. I let the team take a stab at her. I bring her home all alone and unpack a bag for her. We can do it all.
It's Green Talk. We're live. We're back. It's Green Talk Live and more.
On Real Talk Radio with the chef.
I'm Chef Moses again.
I'm Chef Rivera.
Welcome back.
Well, we're waiting for our guests to come on. The surprise guest is no other than Bob Lewis, one of the pioneers of agriculture in America and parts of the world. He co-founded Farm Aid with Willie Nelson and a couple other people that he founded it with, that I'm not sure their names, but it's all good. Great guy. He's one of the coolest people you could meet, one of the realest people you could meet. And he was a mentor to us for many, many years. And we're just waiting for him to come on.
I'm going to say this. Yes, Bob Lewis and John Amorosa. John Amorosa is a gentleman that actually governs the island. He has
in New York. By the way, we're from New York.
He has a place out in Governor's Island. It's a big farm out there. What we do, culinary kids, we teach culinary arts. As you're aware, if you're not aware, farming and agriculture, and we also do fish farming. So we raise and teach how to raise tilapia, shrimps, mussels, crabs, lobsters. And from the first half, you think you definitely know that you're going to need somebody to grow some fresh stuff that doesn't have any cesium-137 in it. No, you start. Yeah, but real talk, there's no other way to say it. So we, not only, we practice what we preach, we are into this green movement, and it was because, believe it or not, Bob Lewis, John Amorosa, Christina Grace, and actually John Amorosa's lovely wife, Linda.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, how are you?
Hey, Linda.
I think without their good food movement and their revolution that they started way back
and
when.
And foresight,
to have enough foresight to start this green revolution, is something very significant. He has allowed us and many others before us, he's paved the way and after, to be able to grow fruits and vegetables in New York City. Right now, this green movement is so ugly. It really truly is. There's no other way to describe it. But because of...
The impact of the environment is becoming more and more prevalent and more of an issue, especially when it comes to food and the fear of food and health risks.
Food security.
We're getting really ugly.
All of these things. So, you know, again, now you have these agro companies coming out, you know, and all of these other companies, everybody's jockeying for position and all these things. But nevertheless, again, it's people such as Bob Lewis, John and Barossa, and, you know, there's other people, but, these are the founding fathers. These were our mentors. These were people that allowed us to
be creative,
and to follow our dreams. Oh, of course, we have to big up Green Thumb. Can't deny Green Thumb, and Parks, Commissioner Blackman, and Parks, right, but no, also Green Thumb, with their new executive director, Nancy. I think we are on a serious charge with this good food movement, this revolution that's going on and that's happening. There were times when there were not as much fruits and vegetables that we had access to.
Mm-hmm.
If you can believe it about now, we're at a point now where there's so much accessibility to fruits and vegetables, but there's still a lack thereof. So if you can imagine back then when there's a story that actually John Amorosa, we were in an article in the New York Times magazine.
Which can be Googled.
And John was saying how in the article he was teaching people how to grow bok choy back then. So, you know, he was revolutionizing, you know, the thing was to change the spectrum and the gambit of what we thought, to challenge our imaginations about food and how it grows and who says that you can just eat carrots and broccoli?
Mm-hmm.
What about a little bok choy? What about a little radicchio? What about, you know, a little something extra? So, you know, this cat is really, he's a mentor, and I love him to death. It's just, like I said, it's just so refreshing to know that there are still people that really care about food and the health concerns and how it's grown. Do you know how your food is grown? I mean, you know, think about what I'm saying. If you eat food, eat fruits and vegetables that are genetically modified, that have no nutritional value, it's like your body is a plant. You need trace elements of minerals and vitamins, niacin, and all these things to stay alive and to stay healthy. An overproductive body that overproduces these minerals, these trace elements, it gets extracted in your urine. So, therefore, if you have no trace elements inside the fruit, therefore your body is not uptaking any nutritional value that is supposed to be inside this fruit that you are eating. So now you can be diagnosed with ADHD and all of these other things. But that's not just the children, the adults. A lack of vitamins, a lack thereof of trace elements of mineral, of the necessity to have certain minerals and vitamins, if you don't have them, you're not going to perform as well. And, you know, that's just what it is. So we can disguise it and call it something, but
without further ado,
I would like to introduce you. It is my pleasure.
And mine too.
And Chef Rivera's pleasure to introduce to you one of the forefathers of the good food movement and revolution in New York City and abroad, around the world, Bob Lewis.
Hey, Bob.
Hey, hello, Marion and Melissa. It's great to hear your voices. How are you?
How are you?
Excellent, excellent. It's a chilly night in New York, and you know, and you know, we always think about what's going next, what's coming next in healthy food and local food, and I was just at a wonderful restaurant which is buying locally, and even in this season they're buying from farmers. So while we look at the snow around us, there are people who are still doing great things, growing food, and they're looking forward to the year to come, as I know you are.
Yep.
Yes, you already know. You already know. The growth, to be able to grow the food and to give the food out to the community, that is something that is needed. So,
and one of the best gifts you can do.
Right.
Well, you've done a lot for your community in Far Rockaway as growers and also as organizers, as teachers.
Thank you, Bob.
And as providers, especially during the recent hurricane disaster that befell, you know, your entire community, given where it's located on the waterfront there. I don't know if folks are listening realize how, you know, you are situated there on the edge of New York City and facing the ocean. Amazing, isn't it? And, you know, you have a great view of the sunrise.
Yeah.
From the water.
But you're quite exposed to the elements, and somehow in this location you've managed to be producers and farmers and raised, I think, a lot of hopes for folks in the community to participate in their own self-help nutritionally and economically. So I tip my hat to you guys, and, you know, that's why I've enjoyed, you know, working with you, and I'm so happy and honored that you asked me to come on and chat with you.
Well, Bob, you know, again, you know, we thank you. And, you know,
without
to be honest pressure, with
Bob.
You, you know, a lot of people don't know the good food struggle before me and Melissa, you know, came on and, you know, gotten to know you over these years.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's people like yourself, even though, you know, we have this thing, but it's people like yourself that have been in the forefront of this movement. And I mean in the forefront, meaning that on the ground in real time, being able to, you know, to, because people in your position just do not do the field work and do the things that you do and have the dedication that you have, and being able to see people's vision, not just one person, but a multitude of people, you know, you can see their vision. But real
you know,
quick,
this starts early in life. I'm fortunate that I grew up, even though I grew up in Brooklyn, and I'm in my 60s, you know, I had the opportunity to farm as a boy in the children's garden at the Brooklyn Botanic Garden, which, of course, is about 100-year-old professional botanical garden, which does advanced research on in botany, but is of course a showplace for nature in the city. And in addition to being that and being a wonderful, beautiful destination to learn about trees and plants and flowers, and it is also a place that cares about community. Food systems and gardening and community gardening and even school gardening or school-age children gardening. And they were among the first to offer that back in the 1920s, so even in the 50s. And as I was growing up, I had a chance to do what I know you've gotten folks to do, which is to farm seeds or results of planting a seed. Might be a carrot, right? Might be corn, beans, and that magical process of planting the seed, caring for it, watching it grow magically, right? And then harvesting it is, of course, a miracle, and for children to have that experience is transformative. So I was fortunate enough to have that early in life in the 50s, and I guess I've carried it all the way through to the point where I'm trying to help others throughout the city and the state, and
mm-hmm.
perhaps even nationally, you know, make it possible for children to have that experience. And you have done that yourself.
Yeah.
Thank you, Bob.
Thank you, Bob.
Career-wise.
That's what now I was going to say that. See, we're both thinking on the same page. Now, we know about your long, illustrious career with State Ag. If you could just, you know, give me your best about State Ag, and I want to, you know, I don't want to talk too much about that, but I just want to give me brief about some of your triumphs, your significant triumphs in State Ag, and also, what are you doing now? I want to hear about what you're doing now.
Well, I think, you know, I shouldn't talk too long. It's a long, long, long story, actually, and worth talking about.
Well, we have time.
You know, I don't want to a whole biography, but I think, you know, you got to recall that what kind of began this, aside from, you know, my being a kid who learned to garden in the city and later visited farms as a child, that, you know, after studying, it turns out, natural science, geology, and then graduate school in planning, along with another planner who's now in his 80s, and that means city planning, a person who was an architect also and a city planner, but really cared about human scale, community-oriented kinds of planning. We started, as you know, the first sort of farmers market of the modern era in New York City, initially in Manhattan, but quickly in Brooklyn and up in Harlem, that same couple of years, 1976. And that really, I say, is the accomplishment that when I look back on it, I consider a foundation for the work that then occurred after that, including the work I did in state government for 35 years. So the beginning of it was the recognition that small farmers were struggling. The number of people involved in agriculture was declining, and the quality of food available to folks in the city of all backgrounds, frankly, of incomes, was poor, to tell you the truth, that it was food that, for the most part, had traveled a great distance, wasn't always very fresh, even if it was refrigerated in that long travel, and that there was a disconnect between the city and the country. So, you know, just to focus on the key points, it was really about reconnecting the city and the country through the institution that we call the marketplace, the farmer's marketplace.
Right.
It may seem like, yeah, so you get that because you've been doing it in your own community, but this was the sort of the beginning of the work that I did, you might say, in agriculture. It wasn't so much in production agriculture, which is all about, you know, growing, whether it's organically or whether it's about vegetables or dairy, meat, or flowers and plants of all kinds of products. It's really about getting the product to the customer and having the customer be able to access that in a manner that would really improve the quality of the food, the freshness of the food, the taste of the food, so important, right? Because it's after all, you're eating it, you're putting it in your body. It's very different than, you know, than watching a TV show. That is what we were trying to do in creating or recreating, reestablishing the markets in the city. And of course, this became a national movement. Colleagues and folks all over the country saw the same thing, whether it was San Francisco, Seattle, New Orleans. And some of these markets had been around for a long, long time. But what was missing was the farmer in the city. And when the farmer in the city could tell the story of who they were and show what they were capable of doing, a new level of respect developed on top of the amazing appearance of this amazingly fresh food. Now we're talking about volume here, not just a small amount, but an amount that a farmer can sell all day long, as many people who want to come. So the more, you know, this developed over the years, and so the work I did in the state government really was to enhance the original couple of years of work in developing the markets and then enable them to operate not just in the center city, but throughout all of the city's neighborhoods. And that involved, you know, the use of special federal and state programs that essentially created an incentive for folks who were not familiar any longer with fresh food or felt they couldn't afford it or never been to a farmer's market to, you know, to basically visit one. And that, and that's the WIC Farmer's Market Program and the Senior Farmer's Market Program and the EBT program, the Wireless Food Stamp SNAP program.
Yep.
So those are the major things that, that have made it possible for the system to evolve to the point where it's really accessible by everybody and that a larger number of farmers is involved, and even urban farmers, as you know.
Right. So what gravitated you to the urban aspect of farming closer to home as opposed to going to the traditional farms like upstate and in different parts of the country where it's more in a rural setting as opposed to being more urban, more touch base for people to gain access to those local food systems?
Well, you know, you have to realize that, you know, we have a city here of 8.5 million people. The idea of growing food, as I mentioned, in a school garden or a community garden is wonderful, and it's a great way for folks to essentially help themselves and take a step towards self-reliance. But it isn't the answer for 8.5 million people. I mean, you know, we're in a mass society here, and of course the system that we're in is geared towards mass production and distribution and so on. But we know the consequences of that have been not so great for the small farmer who can't get in on that system easily, the wholesale system. And it's not been good for the consumer. So, yes, we needed the rural farmer for volume. I mentioned volume before. That's, there's no question we're dealing with, you know, millions of people. So we really need real agriculture to be able to supply that. And we need the farmers to recognize that, that the city folks want them. And that's why the markets are successful, because we have a significant number of farmers and a volume of healthy, fresh, local food that folks can buy. The urban component is a really exciting one. It has the potential, as I said, to give everyone in any community direct experience as a producer. It doesn't mean that it's got the capacity to produce the food that, that traditional, I don't say traditional, I mean even new wave organic agriculture is a country-based system. It has to be in order to produce these volumes. People want to think about, you know, rooftop gardens and rooftop farms, but you have to realize that some of those take huge capital investment on the rooftop, you know, and they're year-round. They may be greenhouse operations, but they're pretty, I'd have to say, capital-intensive, you know what I mean? They and they're hydroponic in many ways. So you don't have the natural soil there. You have essentially plants on life support. And there's nothing wrong with that. There's opportunity for that. There's hydroponic tomatoes. There's hydroponic greens. And there's work that you got involving recycled systems with tilapia. That's all wonderful. Yeah. It's just that we need both. We need both the small farms of the region and and folks in the city to contribute. And frankly, what we really want to see is folks in the city who really are interested in agriculture on a major scale, and I mean a significant family farm of 100 acres, let's say, we'd love to see them take an interest and get and go back into agriculture. There are examples of folks in community gardening who then said, we want to become full-scale farmers. We want to be outside the city. We want to be our own bosses. We want to have a business that we can hand along to our kids and we'll interest them, and so we see that going on. In fact, there are even some classes in New York City in the new farmer development that are open to folks who want to do that. And that just says, you know, we need both. We need folks in the community to create community gardens and urban farms to show what it's about and to give youth access to it, and we need commercial farmers to be able to supply the needs of millions.
Right. So let me ask you a question, Bob. You've done extensive work, you know, globally to a degree and brought the data back. What do you see agriculture looking like all over the world from your experience going to different parts of the world in the next 10, 15 years?
I'm sorry, did you have around the world, are you asking?
Oh, I'm sorry. Because of the experiences that you've had globally going to different parts of the world, dealing with agriculture and sustainable agriculture, where do you see agriculture as a whole collective in the next 10, 15 years?
Well, what's going on is that people are recognizing that there is a real opportunity for the kind of small farmer-based regional agriculture system that we've shown can be revived in New York, and others have shown are being revived all over the U.S., that mm-hmm. same idea that's based on, you might say, the sovereignty of
mm-hmm.
smaller producers, that can take place anywhere. It can happen
right.
in Mexico. It can happen in Haiti.
Right.
It can happen in China.
Yeah.
But it requires the support of municipal government and nonprofit organizations in cities to be
mm-hmm.
able to, in a sense, welcome the farmers. And it's really about welcoming the farmers. And
mm-hmm.
and that, of course, in some cases is not easy because the
yeah.
systems that exist are heavily controlled by
mm-hmm.
Non-farmers, by
mm-hmm.
distributors
mm-hmm.
and wholesalers. But what
mm-hmm.
we've been able to do, and you know that, is enable
right.
the individual farmer to bypass that system
mm-hmm.
so as to survive. So
mm-hmm.
I've been in the Dominican Republic
mm-hmm.
voluntarily, you know, there to help some communities reestablish the bona fide, genuine farmers market where there are no middlemen, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
That's happening in Beijing. I was there this August with organic farmers there
mm-hmm.
with a nonprofit organization that's helping them do the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's really about opening up the opportunity for each area that has agricultural producers
mm-hmm.
to see itself as a producing agent, a producing community for its own local population. And that
mm-hmm.
means a different approach than we see in many places where agriculture is oriented towards export, you know, of specialty crops in great
yeah.
volumes, and folks don't have much opportunity to do more than simply work for a large firm
right.
or share crop, if you know what I mean. And, of course, it's that firm that has the price control. And the difference
mm-hmm.
between a system based on direct marketing, I mean, and I'm talking about good old entrepreneurial direct sales capitalism, small scale
right.
though.
That
is a system that, if it's allowed to flourish, as it has been here in New York,
mm-hmm.
encouraged by government, I must say, by city and
mm-hmm.
state government,
mm-hmm.
if that can also see the same response in other locations, in other countries, like, let's say, in Africa,
mm-hmm.
in Rwanda or in, you know, Zambia. There are places where markets are very traditional, but in fact the markets are not managed for local growers, and they're
yeah.
really organized for the intermediaries, or as you would say in Spanish, the intermediarios.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a really critical distinction, because if the farmers have the opportunity to do this type of direct sales,
mm-hmm.
they will not only get the income that they need to reward themselves for their hard work and then be able to
right.
produce more, but they'll get the respect that they deserve.
Right. Right. Well,
that's the way I see it.
Wow. It's very intricate, the whole agriculture thing, and it's what I like about the movement, especially with the urban agricultural movement, is that it's becoming more of a network. And people, from my experience, people want to learn from one another and, you know, keep it within the create a local food system that is just that, a local food system where people can network and
yeah.
you know, produce product and, you know, perhaps go into manufacturing. Brooklyn is very in the forefront by far as the manufacturing and bringing back the manufacturing of product, which it was such a barren desert for so long. It's good to see that local government and politics support that as opposed to not supporting it. And
yes,
they
do support it, I have to say, despite
yeah.
what people may think. You know, the fact that farmers markets have flourished and that we have other examples of support, such as the shared use kitchen incubators. We can talk a little bit
right.
about that. But you mentioned
yeah.
You mentioned networking and connecting. Well, I'm glad you brought that up because for folks in the city, even if they're not going to be producers of a farm product, that is growers
mm-hmm.
of it
mm-hmm.
in volume, what we're seeing is that they, in a way, have been emulating the farmers by becoming producers themselves, but of a processed
mm-hmm.
item,
mm-hmm.
the ingredients for which they're getting from the farmer. So, in other words, you see all the startups that have been developing in and around the city, and I don't mean just Brooklyn. There are startups
right.
in Queens, startups in the Bronx, startups in, of course, in Brooklyn, but you know, these are folks who are turning tomatoes into salsa. And that has grown tremendously. There have been about 40 small-scale food processing startups in Brooklyn alone last year.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, they need not only ingredients, but they need,
right.
you know, space to produce. They need financing, but they can start small.
Mm-hmm.
Point is that in a way, is another step beyond the farmer's market. That's a place where you can rebuild the local food system by encouraging small-scale manufacturing, which creates jobs and ultimately preserves the harvest, you know what I mean, so that you have a processed product that's available year-round. And we're seeing a lot of that. And for that to happen, we need another institution, which is, I mentioned it earlier, the shared-use incubator, which is really a kitchen space, and you're very familiar with kitchens as chefs, but a shared kitchen so that one or more or even a group, four or five small
mm-hmm.
entrepreneurs can use the kitchen at the same time, and they
right.
can rent
right.
it for a few hours, and they're licensed,
kitchen
is licensed, and they end up with a product that can then be sold directly in a farmer's market, but it's bottled or jarred, labeled, and it can also be sold by stores
mm-hmm.
and even supermarkets. So that's a good example of networking, as you say.
Mm-hmm.
So Bob, let me ask you this. As far as what are some of, you know, since, you know, you're retired now, you know, on paper, just recently, what are some of your plans? Can you divulge some of your plans?
Well, even a little bit.
Just a little bit. Just give us a little taste.
Well, I really, you know, I mean, it's a very new experience for me. If you've been in it doing anything for 35 years, you know, part of you is still interested in it. You're not going to, you know, just drop it. The word retirement, you know, often suggests that somebody's now putting their feet up, you know, or heading for the nearest beach, especially in the winter. And that's definitely a good idea. Who wouldn't want to?
Right.
But also, I don't see myself as that type of retired person. I mean, it's always been my interest in this kind of work as not just work, but in a way as kind of art. It's the creative aspect, as you well know, as growers and chefs. This kind of work can also be thought of as creative planning and facilitating and developing. So, I mean, it's pleasurable. It's enjoyable. And so it's not something I'd want to stop doing.
Right.
And, in fact, as you know, I did it before government, so there's no reason I shouldn't want to continue it. There are some, you know, really great opportunities for all of us out here.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are many young people. There are many programs that have been nurtured over this period of time. Some of them are, you know, the youth markets.
Yeah.
I had a hand in that, and I'm kind of working to see that expand nationally. This is right now a transition. I'm basically volunteering right now. We'll see how things develop, but I believe in that. And so that's one thing. Of course, the New Farmer Development Project, which involves folks who have had experience in agriculture in other countries, being able to resume farming in their new country, for example, New York City,
right.
New York State. That I'm still helping volunteer and guide. There are very, very important things we were doing that I'm still hoping to see happen that relate to the scaling up of what we've done with farmers markets to a bigger scale. In other words, you know about the farmers markets where you buy retail and in the community. There is such a thing as a wholesale version of that, and that's something that New York City really, really needs. And in fact, if we had that and other cities had that, it would mean that it would be convenient for the bodegas and the restaurants and the caterers and, of course, the institutions.
And the food banks, too, because now they're taking it a lot more seriously. As far as the sustainable urban agriculture movement, where stuff that wasn't sold can be given to organizations like City Harvest, who you know very well, and you've worked with in the past,
and a wholesale farmers market to do that. Yes, you're right.
Yeah, so it's you've been so quintessential in the whole movement overall, you know, with John.
And Christina Grace,
many people that we know and we don't know that were, you know, really pivotal in the agriculture movement in New York as well as the country and urban agriculture.
It took us serious.
Yeah.
It took us very serious, so my hat's off to you.
Yep. But nevertheless.
Well, there are many more things to do, and people need to realize the opportunities that are available in any community. I don't know exactly who the audience is here tonight, but whether it's urban or rural, we can come together around these things, and everyone can play a role. Even as a consumer, just a consumer, you know, you can play a role by saying, look, I'm voting with my mouth. I'm going to seek out places where I can get the best, freshest, localist food. I'll know where it's coming from. I know how it's grown. I can spend my dollars there. You can also do more than that. I mean, you can become a member of a cooperative or a community-supported agriculture program. You can help your community or school start a garden in the school. That's very important, as I mentioned, for me, but it's happening all over New York City now. We have about 360 schools that have established actual school gardens at the school. In addition to the playground, there's a place that kids can go outside, and it's part of the curriculum. It's very exciting. That's something that any parent can advocate for, you know. These are things that, you can start a movement in your own community, and there are plenty of resources out there. So, I mean, leaders like you two, you know, have opened up the opportunities and the dialogue in Far Rockaway, but there are folks that are in many other places and folks listening who could be doing that very thing if they aren't already.
Right. I agree. it's imperative, and I think that it's to get into stuff like this. As chefs, that was one passion, but the farm-to-table concept was just a no-brainer for us. And it was, you know, once we left the food industry and retired from that, we were like, well, what do we do now?
Right.
And, you know, things happen, and because, you know, as you know, Far Rockaway is a low economic area and the high crime rate and things of that nature, things transpired that
right.
led us to where we are today, just by the fact that the children really don't, and they still don't. I mean, things are slowly getting a little bit better, but for the most part, these kids really still don't have anything to do. And we
I agree. I know, and that's why it's so important that, you know, you guys are beacons of hope.
Mm-hmm.
And any little step forward, such as, you know, the new program you have there at Farm Rockaway, it's very
mm-hmm.
exciting, and the partnerships
yep.
that you've developed there are terrific,
Thank
especially
you.
Around youth, because that's been your focus, and that's where the future is, the young folks.
Right. But like I said, it's a lifelong passion, and, you know, everybody has their passions, and, you know, ours was food, and, you know, yours was food as well, and also the community and the lack of things in the community. How can I, as a community member, make it better? And how can
Absolutely.
I share that with people and do it in an organized way where people can be receptive to it and be inspired? I mean, there's more gardens in the Rockaways that's coming up for the spring now more than ever on
it's
both
fantastic.
Sides of the peninsula, which is a fantastic movement. And, you know, more organizations are taking it a lot more seriously, because I remember when we started, it wasn't taken as seriously as it is now. And I think everything happens for a reason. And post-Sandy, I think that made everybody, whether they were victims of it or not, really focus on the simple things.
The sustainability.
And the sustainable things, and keeping, you know, like they say, keeping the garden clean and keeping your backyard clean type of thing.
Well, and getting back to basics, you know, recognizing
yeah.
that simple things can be very important, like just surviving
yeah.
and seeing, the pleasure you can get and the pride that you can get from doing
mm-hmm.
something small but significant in your community.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, I guess part of my passion was to help make government effective and responsive.
Yeah.
And I mean, there are elected officials. I wasn't an elected official, but a person in government who had the ability to develop and shape programs and activities
yeah.
that could, you know, make an impact. And but there are, you know, in every place, it is possible for a citizen to present ideas and hope, and hopefully they can be listened to and implemented. I mean, new leaders, I think, are aware of the value of food as an organizing topic. I can say one of the things I've been volunteering to do in here is to assist the new Brooklyn Borough President.
Yeah, which is an
Senator
exciting
Eric,
thing, actually.
Former Senator Eric Adams, who's now the
right.
the borough president of the, you might say, the, what is it, fourth or fifth largest city in the U.S., Brooklyn,
mm-hmm.
alone has almost 3 million people.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he's come in with a real interest in food
mm-hmm.
as an organizing principle for improving the quality of life and the economy and the landscape in all kinds of ways. And so
mm-hmm. I agree.
I'm just saying that any elected official
mm-hmm.
could have that same enthusiasm that he does
mm-hmm.
in seeing what thinking about food in any given community
mm-hmm.
could do in the ways we've been discussing. So we're looking forward. I'm just a Brooklyn native, so this is my civic duty, if you want to call
yeah.
it that.
I feel the same way.
To assist, and
mm-hmm.
there's no reason this can't happen in any neighborhood,
mm-hmm.
And any place, and any community. So I encourage folks to think about that, and the subject of community food systems, that
mm-hmm.
that is the way to approach it. You know,
yeah.
Saying that, hey, put on the food glasses and look around, see where food is in the community, in the schools, in the retail stores, in the institutions, hospitals, nursing
right.
homes, and
mm-hmm.
take a look at what changes one could bring to that, and in terms of, in a way, leveling the playing field, folks who
right.
need access to better food and folks who already have that access. How can we make that access more equitable, if you know what I mean? How can we encourage youth to participate in
yeah.
and see that as an avenue for a career in the ways we've been talking about? There's so many aspects to this.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just saying that particular focus on looking at it, the larger picture, and saying, hey, there's a huge opportunity here to in a way, produce more of what we consume,
mm-hmm.
Still buy our coffee, which we don't grow, you know, and our tea,
mm-hmm.
and things
yeah.
like bananas, which we can't grow. But
mm-hmm.
to the extent that we can grow and produce and manufacture things here, let's do it. And
right.
And let's start small if we have to, but let's,
right.
let's put the pieces together. So that's what I want to leave with you as kind of what I think I'll be doing. And it may be just volunteering, or it may be consulting, as they say. I don't know. Or maybe, you know,
the
if
sky's the limit, Bob.
I'm given an opportunity to work again in government, I would.
Okay.
But you know, Bob, I'm going to say this to you. What you were saying, touch on real quick something that you said. The thing is to inspire the youth, but to also, you know, this is, I like to tell my students, I always tell my students, this might not be what you want to do right now, but this can get you to where you need to be or
after.
Mm-hmm.
You know, by utilizing this to get to another place in your life or whatever the case might be, it's something that, you know, allows you to do some things and to
mm-hmm.
be creative and maybe come up with your own niche or, you know, like I said, to have the insightful around you to make better decisions.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
you know,
we're talking about a lot of social things here, and kids like social things. I mean,
yeah.
for example, as you know, the youth markets isn't about farming, actually. It's basically the kids are running the farmers market. They're
right.
learning about the food. They're proud to be at the forefront in their community once they know what it takes to do this, to be the ones who, in effect, represent that food and those farmers. And guess what? They're making money. So, you know,
right.
that kind of thing is, you know, very appealing. And, you know, yes, they may never want to keep doing that, and they may want to go off and become a lawyer or a doctor.
Right.
Or an engineer, but I can tell you
right.
that just about the entire cast of Law and Order has, at one point or another, I don't mean the stars, but just about all the walk-on actors has sold at the green markets because you know how
wow.
unemployed actors need a little extra income. Let me tell you, everybody's
wow.
had this experience.
Right,
wow.
right, right.
Wow.
And
but
it's not a bad
you know,
thing for the kids
is,
to happen.
I think Chef was asking you about the future of it. And I think the future of it is, you know, it's bright. But I also think that a lot of, you know, these young children are going to be, you know, doing a lot of intricate and futuristic growing and things like that. So, again, it's always good to remember one's roots and to remember the pioneers and to remember the people that started it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like I said, this was... You know, I really feel that, you know, as long as we've known you, that over the years, my thing is that you have been a person in your community that has given so much to so many,
yep.
but is getting so little back in the sense that I know that your love for it is that's all you need.
Yeah.
I mean, I, as far as accolades and all of these things, if it was up to me, I mean, listen, hey, I don't know. I words can't even describe it because, like I said, people do not realize about this food movement
mm-hmm.
and how people such as yourself You know, it could have been into some type of dictatorship or something like that.
No, I mean, you see the joy. You know, how could anyone not be, gratified by what we've seen coming from this? And, you know, I don't need a lot personally. I just had a great lunch, for example, today.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, what's life all about? Family.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully good food,
mm-hmm.
you know, strong friendships,
right.
Community, and some of the things we all want to do, see the world, travel now and then. But, you know, what is satisfaction? Hopefully everyone
mm-hmm.
can find a place for themselves where they can express themselves, their own self, in a way that is satisfying.
Mm-hmm.
And so we hope for, you know, a society and an economy where people are treated as humans and not robots, right? So
right.
We know that in agriculture, in family-based agriculture,
mm-hmm.
there's been so much of that personal growth that can come out of it. We live in an industrial society, but involving agriculture is not taking a step back. People need to realize,
right.
I think we haven't mentioned that tonight, but somehow there's this assumption that somehow progress means always going to a higher level of technology. But,
mm-hmm.
you know, yes, we have the Internet. Yes, we have high technology, and
yep.
most of us don't know how it works, right? But
right.
The fact is we still need to eat, and I don't think we want a world where we're popping capsules, you know. We want the real thing, and as long as we want the real thing, there is a real, real important role for agriculture, and that's not to say that it's not a progress.
Right.
The progress is to how to make, you know, how to make agriculture appealing, because it involves hard work, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
How to make it rewarding economically, both
right.
rural and urban. And that's been the big challenge. We really need more people to go into agriculture and understand that it's not a back-breaking peonage, if you know what I mean. It's
right.
just not about being peasant.
Right.
And certainly folks in the African-American community, we've seen a huge change. It's unthinkable when you think about it. There are kids running the youth markets and farming, in fact, and growing food in Bed-Stuy,
yes.
in the South Bronx, out in your neck of the woods, who are proud of this now. I mean,
mm-hmm.
it's remarkable. I'm sure their parents are shaking their heads. You know, how can this be? I mean,
yes.
you know, we don't think of agriculture in a positive way.
Right.
Right.
So that's been an unbelievable change.
Dirty and, you know, all these things.
It's too much hard work.
Well, yeah, plus the history in the United States of slavery
yeah.
and all of that. Let's
yeah.
face it. I mean,
this is
something that, I mean, when you think of the black urban gardeners or the black
yeah.
urban farmers, the BUG conference that happened in Bed-Stuy this past fall, I mean,
mm-hmm.
you're talking about folks coming together from the North and the South and the Midwest who are all here, you know, talking about how to, you know, raise a kind of the economy in small and bigger ways by
yeah.
working together and sharing ideas. And this is really possible.
Mm-hmm.
We
yeah.
have to get over the old tendency to say it can't be done, or, you know, there's a lot of support out there. That's the thing. And certainly in New York, I could speak for that.
Right.
Well,
agree.
You know what? I think you're right, and I think what needs to be done, too, so that to set the record straight and the track right, I think it needs to be more accessibility to funding.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
That's
on
the one problem.
Yeah. On these scales.
Yeah.
But, you know, all I can say is that hopefully these things, they will come eventually.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not just for, I'm not saying for culinary kids, I'm just saying in general.
No.
And the government is going to understand the significance and how important it is, like you've understood all these years how government and how the bureaucracy
and to move around that,
but you've always been able to, you know, to do what you've done in a professional, fashionable way and get results done as opposed to just bumping gums and, you know, bureaucracy.
Yeah.
You know, so that's what a lot of people, New Yorkers, are going to miss, whether they know it or not.
Yeah.
But, you know, like I said, we need to get, you know, we need to really start pumping this into the children's, you know, onto their plates, man, and serving them up this stuff. This is what we need.
There are a lot more opportunities out there than people may realize. I mean, by the way, it's not only government. Government does have a role, big role, and the federal government, you know, they've made their changes that they needed to make. You know, there are all kinds of issues that led to the big lawsuit against the USDA. But, you know, right now, there are definitely funding available. As you know, in New York State, the federal Hoop House program under USDA
has
been very, very helpful. I mean, really important to have a piece of infrastructure like that, you know, basically a greenhouse operation. I mean, that's doable. That's very critical to have something like that. That exists.
Yeah.
Even in an urban area, which is the trick when it comes to, you know, the Department of Agriculture, which you think is and is mostly focused on rural areas, but that's doable. And then, you know, there are other things. The loan programs are available for the new farmers. We've had workshops in helping them navigate that and put the loans together, the low-interest loans. But in some cases, you don't really even need that. What you need is a market. And you need affordable land to lease or to borrow. I mean, that's why some of these things can be done with very little. It's more like, you know, let's figure out what you want to do, and let's figure out how you can do it.
Do it, absolutely, and get it done. And do it. And if you can't do it in a grandiose way, you can do it in the best economic way possible, depending
on
your budget.
Step by step, you know, so that you don't have to get in over your head and find the whole thing collapsing. No, it involves very careful thinking. And so when we set up these workshops or the new farmer development courses, it's all about, you know, understanding what it takes to be an entrepreneur, what the landscape is, where you can get that support. So for folks interested in that, you know, I think that's a very good model. That's the Green Market New Farmer Development Program. And there's also, you know, in New York City, Just Food has its farm school, which is a nonprofit. It's really not a government program at all, and neither is the New Farmer Development Project. That's really funded by, well, it's funded by USDA and by government and foundations, but both of these are very innovative ideas that could happen in any community and really should. There's no reason that this kind of stuff can't happen just about anywhere.
Well, my favorite part about your career personally is the farming. And, we've talked about things and we talked about business over the years, but the question that I have for you, Moses, is how did that come about? We never really had time to sit down and me to ask you that question. How did Farm Aid come about? I mean, I brought it up because of the funding aspect. Farm Aid, for people that do or don't know, Farm Aid has been quintessential in the farmer agricultural movement as far as funding farms that had a lack thereof and, you know, really helped farmers that were really struggling across the country to maintain their farms and to continue mass production for the public. So while we're here, I would love to know how did that start?
Well, Farm Aid, you know, began in around 1985, and it started when there was a real crisis in the Midwest.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of farmers were going bankrupt, basically, and you saw all kinds of terrible stories. I mean, foreclosures and suicides and just really terrible events occurring. Now, you know, sometimes it takes leadership from a person, just an individual. It happened to be that, you know, Willie Nelson was talking about this The story is true. There was the big Live Aid concert focused on hunger in Africa and elsewhere. And these were artists, performing artists. Bob Dylan was there. I believe Willie said, this is such a success, we need to do something about the American farmer. And it was Willie who decided, understanding the importance of family farms to America, that that in Illinois, in Champaign, Illinois, with other performers. And his friend John Mellencamp from Indiana, and then Neil Young, and later Dave Matthews joined. So the four of them became the board of directors of Farm Aid. And they simply put on an annual concert that raises funds, significant funds, that enables the Farm Aid organization, which is based in Boston, to, to run a national program to help raise farmers' hopes, in some cases fund small programs, operate a national hotline, but basically advocate and use the power of the artist's fame to say this is an important thing. And not only are farmers important, but the entire good food movement is important. That involves reaching into cities, building building relationships with cities and folks in cities, and making agriculture relevant to their lives, very relevant, so that you know, it can happen right in the city as well as on the farm. This is very difficult because it means reaching reaching across the urban-rural divide. But that's so important, and that's what the my work has been about all these years. So just in a nutshell, the Farm Aid helped New York, believe it or not, on 9/11. There was the big farmers market, the big green market, operating that day, which was a Tuesday, at the base of the World Trade Center. You know, that market had to be abandoned. The trucks were left, of course. They were all destroyed. Farmers, thank goodness, escaped. Some of us, I was working in government then, of course, and we, we wanted to help those farmers recover, just like you have the Sandy recovery problem. We wanted to help them recover their equipment so that they could continue. And so Farm Aid actually helped with that. We established a statewide fund, and they contributed a significant amount of money. This was, you know, 2001, right? 13 years ago. And then later, when Katrina happened, the farmers in New York contributed to helping the farmers in New Orleans, and they had lost their packing sheds, and the shrimpers had lost their docks and their boats, and so folks in New York went to Chicago for the Farm Aid concert then, 2007, and you know, that's when we began to have a more regular relationship, and ultimately Farm Aid decided to have its concert in New York in 2007, and you know, that's when we had the first youth market at the big concert of 25,000 people. So, you know, ever since, we've had a youth market at every single Farm Aid concert. This year was up in Saratoga Springs. Last year was in Pennsylvania and Hershey. I don't know where it'll be in 2014, but I encourage everyone to go and be part of the big all-day-long learning experience and celebration. But that's how the Farm Aid program developed. And anyone can find out more about what they do by just going to the website, you know, farmaid.org. But it's a great organization. And those four guys totally donate their time. That's those concerts are completely based on performers donating all of their time, and it's therefore very
appreciated,
without unlike question. Any other concert you can imagine. It's the longest, I'd say by far, running concert series of its kind that's strictly charitable and dedicated to a cause like this.
Wow. I appreciate the time that you've put into Farm Aid, and as well as the other four board members. It's been, you know, it's like one hand washed the other and both washed the face. And it's, you know, people should, you know, I've learned from it. I haven't been to Farmed yet, but I will go, either if it's not this year or next year. But, you know, it's, you know, that stuff is really important in the food movement, especially with what's going on with the environment. I think that we as the American public and consumer, as well as the globe, how can I say,
better care
and watch things a lot more carefully.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, that Farm Aid has a long history, but, you know,
mm-hmm.
anyone, we could have a small concert in Far Rockaway. People
mm-hmm.
can, you know, create an event around this theme.
Mm-hmm.
There could be other performers who decide to come and
yeah.
Understand the same things that Willie Nelson and the other folks have, that this is important. You know, create a festival, if you want to call it that, that folks will come to and be willing to pay a price to come. And that, of course, that is, goes to the programs. After they pay the expenses of running the concert and paying folks to be ushers and all that. A lot of folks do volunteer for things like that, by the way, but naturally you've got costs that have to be expended, you know,
mm-hmm.
equipment, light, stage, and all that. But when it all comes down to it, you know, you have a pot of funds that could be used for this purpose. That's just one way of doing it. I mean, but that is a unique way, right, other than government, other than private sector. And I believe that in every community there are people of goodwill.
Yes.
In every walk of life who would want to step up, whether it's an elected official or a
mm-hmm.
philanthropist, right, or a company who wants to be associated with this good thing, this good food movement,
mm-hmm.
I wouldn't hesitate, you know, if you have but it's really important to plan, as you
right.
have for Rockaway, you know, a solid
yeah.
program that won't, you know, go under. You know,
right.
That is based on citizen input. That's on based on people's needs. That
yeah.
And if you do that, I think that we can move this whole movement forward
yeah.
in each place and even internationally. Like you asked about before, no question about it, folks. Folks realize that we've had mayors, by the way, come to New York from other cities, saying,
right.
"Wow." You know, and it's so ironic, right, to have agriculture in the America's largest city, in the heart of the city that's thought to be, you know, that never sleeps, that's the epitome of urban life. I mean, to think that agriculture is playing such an important role here
mm-hmm.
in the quality of life. I mean, isn't that fascinating? And
yeah.
that folks from Japan or from China, and I've been,
yeah.
you know, I've helped them understand.
Yes, you have, Bob.
What
yes,
this
have.
Is, I must say, it's all because of the farmers. If it weren't for the farmers doing this, this is what Willie would say too. It's,
exactly.
It's those folks. If it weren't for them, we wouldn't have this. So,
exactly.
you know, God bless them and everyone who produces food from the land and.
Mm-hmm.
And simply wants to be able to afford to be able to do that, family and for the rest of us. So, you know,
mm-hmm.
this is a profession that is so noble. I mean, think about
yeah.
it in America today, how few people produce anything, right?
Right.
So when you get back to basics and you can produce food, I mean, that's where the kids get fascinated. You mean you grew that?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
They get amazed every time we go through that in the urban farms that we have out here in the Rockaway. It's always a fascination and, you know, getting in touch because, you know, being in a city environment, it's like a concrete jungle to a large degree. So that was why that we wanted to create the urban farms that we have created with the help
right.
of State Ag and Green Thumb and Parks. That, you know, let's get back to the basics. Let's get back to nature. It's, you know, New York City is not, I mean, if you go out upstate, it's something different. But in New York City, it's more industrial. It's more fast-paced.
Commercial.
It's more commercial. It's more quick. Everything is quick, 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 quick. But
yeah.
there's a time, yeah, you know, and there's a time in life where you just want to slow down, especially when you get older. You want to slow down and enjoy things. You done did everything that you can humanly possibly do to contribute.
And in fact,
society.
we have a lot of seniors. You know, there may be this year the first senior market. We talk about youth markets, right?
There's
no reason that folks, as you say, who are a little slower. And I am one of them. I try to walk fast. Let's put it that way. Anyway. That they can't play a big role in this. But it doesn't have to be one or the other. We've seen intergenerational programs where kids and seniors are enjoying the collaboration. And the kids are, yes, faster. And the seniors like that. They like to watch the live act. You know that. So, there's no one who can't engage in this in some way. And when I say the senior market, some of them are growers in small ways, but others are just going to be involved in the distribution of healthy local food. For example, in what we call the food box programs that can occur where a distribution of a pre-ordered local food box or an order comes into a housing project and then is distributed to those who ordered it in advance. You know what I mean? Almost like a buying co-op. We have a good example of that in New York, the Corbin Hill Project in the Bronx, which has got about 1,000 people receiving an order like that from New York State Farms upstate. That's another model. It doesn't have to be farmers market. It can be a pre-order cooperative that works with farms. So, again, there is no one size fits all.
Right. It's just so much. I mean, it can be overwhelming to people that are just grasping and coming on the show. But like I said before, and for you don't know, Bob, we created the show just for this kind of venue because I always felt that the food movement needed a larger voice and the environmental movement needed a larger voice than it was getting. And I want people to touch the people that help make the decisions and listen to their perspective on what's going on, as opposed to just reading. I would rather listen to you right now as Bob Lewis saying things from your perspective verbally than to hear an article. I mean,
we're articles, or a transcript.
So we just
naturally. I mean, a conversation is always interesting, and you know, people love talk radio. They like to be able to ask and call in too. But there are so many great people to interview in doing this work that you know they often do not have their voices heard, as you know. You're going to make that possible with this show. We all know how many folks are out there, and I know how articulate they are and how passionate they are about what they've done. And I think, you know, if folks are listening, and this is a great and I would hope, really interesting opportunity, and I would hope that they tune in for every single show because I know you're going to have other folks, other guests.
We're planning that now, and we're trying to give as much versatility as we possibly can to different demographics, so they can all grasp it and talk to people. Like I said, talk to people that are the political people, the people that are in government agencies, that are in those higher up echelons that you can listen to and hear what's going on. But sometimes articles, as us being victims of articles too, they don't really tell the whole story. It's
they
don't give it justice. So, you know, we got tired of that. I mean, as a nonprofit organization, as Culinary Kids, as we are, of course you do need that outside press. But sometimes because of, you know, what market they need to target and all that stuff. You already know, Bob, not everything that you're saying comes to fruition in an article.
No, but, you know, obviously articles are very widely read and they make a big impact depending on where they're printed. But the oral tradition is also very important. I have to say, you know, one of the kids from the projects who became, part of the youth market initiative in Manhattan Do you believe he was at the press conference at Farm Aid sitting next to Willie Nelson and Neil Young and spoke very eloquently? This is, I mean, a young person whose enthusiasm for the work that he'd accomplished. He'd not only, you know, become a regular youth market participant, operator, but he, you know, in a year or so, he became a supervisor of other youth. In other words, he learned to do it so well, and he was good at it that he was given the opportunity of giving other youth the orientation. So, you know, here he was asked to speak at the national press conference that was held up in Saratoga Springs this summer at Farm Aid. I mean, I could send you a photograph of this. It's
okay.
Remarkable.
Actually, I saw the photo. Him show me the phone. I mean, no, excuse me, the camera. I remember that one. With the gentleman you're talking about.
Yeah, well, I mean, there are a few folks, and I could send you their contact info, so you could conceivably give them an opportunity to speak to a larger audience this way. But I must say, you know, they have certainly impressed everyone at that press conference. With the fact that here are these young people who were transformed in a positive way, positive energy, by their experience in connecting up with healthy local food, food access, farmers, and so on. I mean, this is not what most people would think of when they think of, you know, agriculture, right?
What you're saying, Bob, is true, because, I mean, even though we do agriculture in the sense of the old-fashioned way, we also do it in the way, well, I mean, raising, fish farming is not anything that's new. It's old and it's ancient anyway. But to have a system now where you can grow fruits and vegetables by utilizing the waste byproduct of fish to actually grow these organic produce, to bring them to fruition, and knowing that they have essential vitamins and minerals inside of them. So I think what is really popular with the young adults now is that the science behind the growing has become more of an integral part, because now we're stepping away from the pesticides and the herbicides, and we're dealing with an organic product. And, you know, it never ceases to amaze me the wonders that young adults experience, knowing that, well, wow, I'm about to embark on learning about these fish and, you know, growing fruits and vegetables. I never even knew you could grow fruits and vegetables using fish waste. Oh, my God, you know, like I said, it's the level of excitement and enthusiasm and anticipation for this is a beautiful thing. But, you know, also besides the growing of the tilapia, the shrimps, the lobsters, the crabs, and mussels, it's also, too, about ornamental and teaching the children how to not just food that we eat, but ornamental fish, discus fish, you know, different types of fish, different types of ornamental fish and stuff like that. So,
what you're doing is giving people the practical exposure to something that they would not normally get at school. And, you know, it's about a real-life experience that can speak to somebody who might not understand the relevance of studying science at all.
Exactly.
You know how difficult it is to get folks motivated to math or science in general, unless they somehow grew up completely surrounded by it. But by immersing people in this, this is why when I say about youth gardens, it's so important for every child to have that experience, that magical experience of being a producer, to see the response of a carrot growing up and then being harvesting that carrot. That's so transformative. But what you're talking about is the same thing. You're breaking right through that sort of wall that separates folks from opportunity that they can grab. This is about really an outreach that you've been able to do in a very practical way. And as I said, that young fellow who spoke at the press conference, you know, if it hadn't been for the youth markets, I don't think that, you know, his inherent intelligence, you know, would ever have seen the light of day. You never know, because, you know, this opened up for him an opportunity to get appreciated and then to give back. And it involves hands-on experience. So you're doing that. The more there are folks who volunteer like you have as educators in the community, you might say it's an after-school thing. It may have to be an after-school thing until schools adopt this on a regular basis. And, you know, I'm not saying, you know, folks should do, you know, avoid science, in fact, if they want to go on to college and become involved in a high-tech career. But there's no reason why everybody shouldn't be exposed to something practical that could, you know, encourage them to go and do those things that understand the science behind it. So just like you guys have understood the science behind the tilapia and the aquaculture, this is extraordinarily important, the experiential work that you do. So, you know, kudos to you. You are the real heroes offering this. And you need a little help to make it available as a community-wide service. That's the more you can be self-sufficient and be able to be a business as well as a educational program, the better. There's no reason you can't be both. So I have to say, we need folks like you, and I hope this program can inspire some folks to think about these practical ideas that can be done in their own community.
Definitely.
With that being said, ladies and gentlemen, Bob Lewis. Applause.
I don't know who's applauding, but thank you for whoever you are.
Well, Bob, again, we'd like to thank you.
Thank you so much for doing our first show.
And thank you for also being a great friend, mentor, and everything else in between.
Well, again, I'm listening to the next shows. If you help me learn how to do that, because I'm new with it, and
for edification, every Thursday
from seven
to nine is going to be Green Talk Live and more on Real Talk Radio.
I'd be happy to help you publicize this too in my own way, let me know how I can be of help.
Definitely, Bob.
We're gonna talk behind the scenes, Bob. All right.
Okay. Well, good night, folks. And again, my thanks for the opportunity to chat. It's always great to hear your voices, and I really applaud your work in kicking off this new project. And I know that you'll make a lot of new friends as a result, and you deserve to, because you're such great people.
Thank you, Bob.
Thank you.
Have a good evening.
Bye-bye.
Have a good night,
Bob.
Bye-bye.
Well, good night, guys. The first show was really great. The feedback was excellent. The chat room went really well. And, like, you know, Chef, say what you're going to say.
Well, you know what? Before I say before I close, I want to thank, again, I want to thank Bob Lewis for our first show. It was only right. We're going to have some more things coming. I don't know, Chef, listen. It's Green Talk Live and more.
On Real Talk Radio with the Chef.
I'm Chef Moses, your host.
I'm Chef Rivera. Thank you so much. And next week, we'll be talking about more environmental issues and agricultural issues. And you take care till next week.
Go green, baby. Go green.